I am Scott Spears, your announcer, and welcome to the Larry Zbysko Podcast. Welcome to Larryland, episode number one. And now, without any further ado, live from Larryland, USA, wrestling's one and only living legend, the legendary Larry Zbysko. Larry, how are you?
Well, I'm doing good. Thanks for the introduction there, Scott, and like you said, episode number one.
Of 1,000, Larry.
1,000?
Of 1,000.
Yeah, well, we'll see. You know, I'm like to let the audience know off the bat that in terms of podcasts and social media and smartphones and computers, I'm a dinosaur. I don't do any of that stuff. I have my my old Razor flip phone. and brother, that's it.
Well, Larry, we are going to go into the 21st century here with the Welcome to Larryland podcast.
Well, thanks. And, you know, it's interesting. I've been, you know, thinking about it a bunch and have really no idea what to say. I never really listened to podcasts. I've been on a couple of them. And it seemed to me like some years ago when this started, everybody had a podcast. I didn't even think of doing one because it seemed everybody had one. And, God, how many years has podcast been going on anyway?
Well, probably at least a decade now.
Well, no, 10 years of everybody talking like wrestling experts.
Well, there may be a lot of experts, but there's only one living legend. Is that correct, Larry?
Well, unfortunately, no. I mean, Bruno, I still miss him. We used to talk a lot, and we were close. And if anybody, you know, was a living legend of the sport, you know, Bruno's the guy. I just stole it from him. But, you know, when I think about it, really talk about the era that I come from, there's really only a handful of guys like me left that, you know the business the way it was and how it makes money and how it works and how it gets the fans to love it, you know, and get involved in it. So it'll be interesting. We'll see what happens.
Well, Larry, this week's episode, we're going to do a little tease here because we do have some merchandise from wrestling's one and only living legend at this current time.
We do, Larry.
So we're going to talk about that midway through the episode here, and we're going to do this once a week. But the subject of this week's episode is going to be how Larry got into the wrestling business and what Larry's childhood was like, because we really don't know that from the living legend. So we're going to hear it right from the legend's mouth and tease that next week's episode, because we've heard so much about this, Starrcade 97... WCW's biggest buy rate ever. The, I would say, secondary main event that night was Larry Zbysko versus Eric Bischoff, another person who's doing a podcast now, a very successful.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, Eric still got one? Okay.
Eric still got one. And we're going to talk about how that all happened and Larry's memories from that next week. So stay tuned. The second episode will be Starrcade 97 and Eric Bischoff and Larry Zbysko, and how far that relationship goes back to the AWA days. And that's the tease.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting story. So we'll throw some stuff in. I think we'll surprise the fans.
Absolutely. Larry, let's just start here, because I think this is a nice road to go down for episode number one. Where did the living legend Larry Zbysko grow up? What was the childhood like?
Well, you know what? The childhood was, God, a different era. I was born in 1951 on the south side of Chicago, and kind of grew up in Chicago as a little kid. My dad moved to Lansing, Illinois, which was a suburb of Chicago close there, because he worked for U.S. Steel. And then when I was about 12 years old, it was a normal, you know, back then when I was a kid, it was a very family-orientated kind of childhood where the families all lived, you know, in the same area. So one week you'd go visit this grandfather, and the next week you'd go visit this grandfather, and all the holidays, the whole family would, you know, meet up at someone's place because they were all around the Chicago area. So it was the old days where there was a lot more family connection. And, you know, when you came home, you didn't bother locking your doors. You could park your car outside your house and not lock it. It was a different world. And 51, it was also the beginning of basically the television era. When, I'm not sure exactly when television was first invented and started, but, you know, in 1951, you know, everybody seemed to have a TV, but that was fairly new, you know, technology that the world flipped over, you know, television and television shows. And one of the first shows ever that was popular and fit into the live TV, which was a new thing, was professional wrestling. And that's how, you know, professional wrestling got so popular, because it was the perfect show for the brand new thing, television.
Now, Larry, what was wrestling like in that era? Who do you remember seeing on the tube? Who did you like? Who were you a fan of?
Well, this is interesting, because I didn't see wrestling till I was like 12 years old. I mean, growing up in Chicago, but then when I was about 12, my dad got transferred to Pittsburgh. He worked for U.S. Steel, and that was their office headquarters, went in Pittsburgh, and he was an accountant.
I thought that'd be a good...
So off we moved to Pittsburgh, and I remember driving into Pittsburgh for the first time as a kid, and on the movie marquee, the big movie that was out was Goldfinger. So that tells you about what year it was. Of course, I wasn't allowed to see Goldfinger, because Goldfinger was too risque. It was considered a risque movie back in those days. But that was the first time I saw wrestling, was in Pittsburgh. It was Channel 11 Studio Wrestling, hosted by, Chili Billy Cardill. And the first wrestlers I've seen were the local guys. But the guy that stood out that really got me was the heavyweight champion of the world, this guy named Bruno Sammartino. And he was the most impressive looking, I mean, unbelievable looking guy for his day. And I watched professional wrestling, got into Bruno. He was my hero. And it hit me. And from that day, you know, at age 12, 13, year of watching, professional wrestling, I wanted to be one. That's all I could think about. And at the age of like 13 or so, I mean, I started wrestling, amateur wrestling in eighth grade, which in Pennsylvania was one of the few states that had amateur wrestling that young. So I started wrestling right away. In between the wrestling seasons, I take martial arts because I wanted to, you know, learn as much as I could about, one-on-one competition, because I want to be a professional wrestler. And that's how it started. The other thing that, you know, as I get older and wiser, you realize, you know, the reality of life. But when I saw professional wrestling for the first time, and I was in, I think, eighth grade when we moved to Pittsburgh, I knew one thing already from the first day of first grade, is that I just didn't want to be involved in the normal daily 9-to-5 existence that 99% of the people lived in, you know, including my dad. He'd be up every morning, put his suit and tie on and his hat, and go off, you know, to drive downtown, and every, you know, night at 5:36, be back with his suit and tie and have his martini. And I didn't want to be in the normal world. And I didn't know it at the time, but professional wrestling was something that kept you out of the normal world. The guys who made it in the business and lasted weren't normal.
Larry, before we continue on here, because we want to learn how you got into the business, but one thing you talked about there was the evolution of wrestling on television. And this is a neat thing that we are offering with this podcast, because for those of you out there listening who don't know, the living legend Larry Zbyszko still watches Monday Night Raw. Now, one thing we are not going to do on this podcast is talk about Monday Night Raw every week. But if you would like to know what Larry Zbyszko thinks about Monday Night Raw, or you would like to ask him a question about Monday Night Raw, there's a new one every Monday, and you can talk to Larry each week. Here's how you do that. All you do is you will pay $50 through PayPal, and the Living Legend will give you a call, and you can talk about that week's episode of Monday Night Raw. Now, here's how you do this. You send an email at this point to osukid2006@aol.com. Say you want to talk wrestling with the Living Legend. We'll send you over to the PayPal account. You pay the $50, and then you got the legend on the line to discuss Monday Night Raw, which we will never discuss on this program. Now, back to studio wrestling and Bruno Sammartino, Larry. In those days, give people an idea of what wrestling on television looked like as opposed to what we see now.
Well, when you watched it in those days, here's what you saw. I mean, if you were watching a boxing match and you were watching professional wrestling, it basically looked exactly the same. You know, one guy would come out from one dressing room and the other guy would come out from another dressing room, but inside the ring would be the guy in the suit and tie, the announcer. There'd be a referee standing next to him, and the announcer would say, "Well, welcome to tonight's, you know, main event." And the doctor at ringside is Dr. So-and-so. There was, you know, always a doctor at ringside. And, you know, this guy versus that guy. But it looked exactly like a professional boxing match looked. It looked exactly like a professional sport would look. If it was a real, you know, sport, it would look just like that, with the doctor at ringside, the announcer in the ring next to the referee, the two guys in each corner kind of moving around and loosening up. And then the guys would step out and ring the bell and off they'd go. Where today, you don't have that look of a sport, but, you know, some guy will come out with a microphone and do an interview for 10 minutes. So you want to slit your wrist sometimes. And then someone will interrupt them, and then someone will interrupt them, and then there's all of a sudden a six-way that starts now. But, you know, so it was completely different, and it looked like a heavyweight boxing match, you know. It looked like it should look.
Larry, you talked about Bruno Sammartino being the guy when you were watching as a young guy, and you talked about it being the look. Besides the look of Bruno Sammartino, what was the appeal that he had over that whole crowd, television, in the arena, Madison Square Garden, that he had for so long?
Well, here's the thing with Bruno. Bruno, but he reached, you know, everybody. It wasn't an ethnic thing like, well, Bruno Sammartino, he's from Italy, so the Italians loved him. Everybody loved him, you know. You didn't care if you were an Italian or a French guy or a black guy or a yellow guy or a red guy or a brown guy or how many guys we got nowadays. Everybody loved Bruno because he epitomized what the American dream was and came from a time after World War II. which was a horrible time in humanity. But here comes Bruno, who was, you know, a little kid, 12 or whatever, 10, 12, escaping from the Nazis through Europe with his mother and brother, and living in the mountains, starving to death half the time, and his mother would sneak into a town and get a loaf of bread or a piece of cheese and sneak back up into the mountains where they were freezing half the time and to feed her two kids. And she got shot in the leg one time, escaping from the Nazis. And by the time Bruno made it to the States, he was suffering from malnutrition. And that was one thing that kind of had an effect on his heart, which kind of led to him, you know, going at 82 years old. But then, you know, so this kid who, you know, was almost dead when he got to America, the land of opportunity, because it was America and you know, the great place of freedom, he became, you know, the heavyweight champion of the world. So it was a living guy who made the American dream come true, because everybody wanted to prosper in those years after such a ridiculous, you know, World War II situation. So Bruno was like a light. I mean, you know, he was someone to be like. And when he made his interviews, here you had this guy that looked like he could, you know, just kill you and walk through a wall, because he could. I mean, but he was a very humble individual and very soft-spoken most of the time. And people just loved him. They really loved him. And it's hard for people to imagine today, and even when I go down like to the PC sometimes, because I'm in Orlando, Larryland, here in the Performance Center with the WWE's right down the road, and then Full Sail where they film, you know, NXT's right down the road. And once in a while I pop in and I'll talk to some of the guys, and even they have a hard time, you know, putting their finger on it. They can't imagine stuff like this. But when Bruno would wrestle, and he'd be in the arena or the garden, and someone like Ivan Koloff or George Steele would do something to him, and Bruno would fall down to the you know, ring mat, and he was bleeding, people in the audience got heart attacks and died. One time, four people died in the Pittsburgh Civic Arena. That was like a record. Sick record that it was, but that's how much people truly loved the guy and were into the emotion of the sport. When Bruno, you know, was getting beat up, people had heart attacks.
It's an amazing time to juxtapose.
It's not going to happen today.
Well, that's why to juxtapose that time, which is not that long ago, it's certainly not ancient history, to today, how it's done on television and in arenas. What would you say is the major difference? People having heart attacks and literally dying.
Well, the difference is going to take some episodes to explain. Otherwise, this is going to turn into an hour of college lecture on the reality of life. But professional wrestling does its best and is the hottest when it reflects what's going on with humanity. And back then, the human race, I don't want to say was gullible and naive, but especially when it came to television, which was brand new, and even in the 50s, 60s, you know, early 70s, what people saw on TV, they believed. You know, I mean, in the, you know, back then, you know, people believed what they saw on TV. Nowadays, you know, if you watch the news, no matter what news you watch, people don't believe anything because they know better. But it was just how wrestling followed the age of humanity, and the eras of wrestling changed. I can explain that more a little different, but
You know, and that may be a future episode, because there is something to that. I heard somebody explain it one time as society, and I think this is pretty much what you were saying, Larry, society has become so coarse in a way. You know, people are having shoe bombs on airplanes, so it's hard to get worked up when a guy's got brass knuckles.
Well, you kind of hit the nail on the head in a way, but just to make a long story short, and we'll go back to the wrestling, but we're living at the end of an age. You know, if you read the ancient Indian myths, you're talking about the Kali Yugas, the Yugas. We're at the end of the Kali Yuga. If you talk about some other ancient writings from the Golden Age to the Silver Age, we've been living in the Iron Age, the age of most density, where some things become stupid, and the human race experiences the extremes of absurd senselessness, absurd complexity, absurd what you might call evil. I mean, when I was a kid, no one ran into a school and shot 17 kids. You know, I mean, so, and the other thing is, if anybody even would do anything like that, they would have been hung. Why aren't these people hung that do something like that? That's what I want to know. Why does, you know, the human race put up with kissing the butt of evil? I don't get it.
It's interesting, Larry, because there was a mentality for a long time that we're not going to put up with it. And now that mentality is a little different.
Well, yeah, and, you know, in terms of wrestling, again, which reflects where humanity is, people really have a hard time believing or buying anything, because half of what they hear they know is bullshit. So, and you can see the reaction in the crowd. Like, I don't want to talk really about wrestling too much on the phone. I've heard some, you know, podcasts. I really never listened to podcasts. I don't, you know who has them or what. But the few I listen to is, you know, kind of just rub me the wrong way. I'm still old school. It wasn't bred in me. And when I hear people, you know, talk like they're smart and want to expose everything, I don't like to hear that. I hate that. And I won't talk about it on the... It takes all the fun away from the fans.
That is absolutely... Right.
Know, I mean, that's the other thing about today is people are a lot smarter and less gullible about certain things. And the wrestling fans today are really 100% or the complete opposite of what they were in the 50s and 60s, when if the good guy went down, the audience, you know, someone had a heart attack. You know, nowadays, it's the opposite. I remember not too long ago on Raw, Seth was the good guy, and Dean Ambrose was still there, so he stabbed Seth in the back and beats him up, and was, I guess, supposed to be the bad guy now. But if we did that in the 50s, 60s, or 70s, the guy who did that would have to run out the back, because people would hit the ring or riot and throw crap at you and try to jump over the rail and hit you. I mean, you know, they hated you for that. But after, you know, that, Dean walks up through the audience, and he stops, and he's smiling, and people are patting him on the back and laughing and clapping. So, because, you know, people go out of their way to take all the excitement out of it. I mean, I don't think the fans want to hear it anymore. They're too smart. And for them to enjoy it and really get into it, they don't want to know. You know, they want to watch it and enjoy it, because they don't know what's going to happen.
You know, that's it's a very weird juxtaposition, Larry, before we move on from this subject so we can get back to how you got into the business, because it is a fascinating story. But when you think about it, that is very strange, because in a time when life was more peaceful and less coarse, people had heart attacks and fans would try to beat the tar out of the wrestlers. But in a time when we're more coarse, our language is more coarse, what we see is more coarse, people don't even attempt that. They're standoffish. They're stand backish. You would think it'd be the reverse.
Yeah, you'd think. I mean, you know, it was interesting because I remember when I was in the AWA and we started on ESPN, it was like 1984 or somewhere around there. But back then, I mean, there was a time when the era was changing. The old school kind of ended around the beginning of the 80s. And then by 83, 84, a new era was starting, an era of pay-per-view and an era of characters that all look surrealistic. The Bruno, San Martino, the Luthes, the Vern Gagne, the guys that were just, you know, people and human beings, they were gone and everybody became a character. And nobody was like a real thing. It was the Hulk or the Macho Man or the Hot Rod or the Superfly or the, you know, everybody became a character, and the era changed. Even in the movies where the guys who used to be the good guys became like the idiot, and the bad guys became the good guys because they'd shoot you and take all your money. That was cooler. So humanity kind of changed, and wrestling, you know, kind of follows it.
Absolutely, and it's hard to believe we're midway through episode one here, so I do want to let the fans know that aside from having Larry call you and talk about Monday Night Raw, if you want a piece of the living legend himself, there's nothing better than an authentic, personalized, autographed photo, 8x10 autographed glossy from the living legend Larry Zbyszko, which again, if you email osukid2006@aol.com and let us know that's what you would like, $25, a color 8x10 glossy autographed by the legend will be coming your way personalized. And Larry, no more to your house, right? We're going to do it this way from now on.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I get them here, but yeah, that's not, it's not good. I mean, I feel bad because a lot of people probably send stuff out that never come back, but I never get it because who knows where it goes.
This is a sure.
I don't know if people, I mean, some people say, you know, you can find your address, but I don't know if they got the right address on that.
This is a surefire way that it will be authentic, it will be personalized, and you will get it back. $25. osukid2006@aol.com. Let us know, and we will send you to the PayPal. $25. That's a lot more realistic than what you would see at a Comic-Con at this point. So get those fast. Now, Larry, you're growing up. You don't want a 9-to-5 job, and you don't want to do what your father's doing and most people are doing. You've seen Bruno Sammartino. He's your guy. You want to be a professional wrestler. You don't know Bruno. What happens?
Well, like I said, I was wrestling in high school and, you know, wanted to get ready to be a pro. And my mother did some volunteer work at a little school. And this is a weird story, too. It was a little Catholic school called St. Sebastian in Pittsburgh on the North Hills, a suburb of Pittsburgh. And Bruno's kids went to that school. So my mother found out Bruno's address. And she knew I was a big Bruno fan, and somehow, I really don't remember how, but she basically gave me the address. You know, through my mom, I found out Bruno's address, which was about a few miles from my house. And when I turned 16 and got my, you know, driver's license and my first $300 Ford Falcon piece of crap, every time I went that direction, I'd, you know, go a block out of the way, and that street I turned off on would go by Bruno's backyard, the side of his house and his backyard. And you really couldn't see in his backyard because there was this gigantic, you know, hedges all around the yard. And so I wasn't really like a stalker, but every time I went that way, I drove past Bruno's house just in case, you know, I get a chance to see him. And one summer day, I'm driving by, and just for a second, you know, through these thick hedges, I see this massive body, and he was standing up in his backyard by his swimming pool getting a suntan. So I couldn't help it. I don't know what happened. I hit the brake, and I didn't know how to get in because that side of the house was nothing but, you know, just one gigantic wall of big hedges. So I started just crawling through this guy's hedges. I couldn't help it. And, you know, as I was coming through, I'm thinking, oh, my hero is right there. So I crawled through his hedges into his backyard, and he looks over and sees me, and there's this, you know, 16-year-old, you know, pimply-faced kid coming through his hedges. I'm really surprised he didn't crack up. But, you know, he was looking at me, and I got in his yard, and I walked up to him, and I was very, you know, humble and polite and said, I'm sorry, but you're my hero. I saw you. I couldn't help it. I just have to just say I'm your biggest fan, and, you know, I've been dreaming about being a wrestler ever since I moved to Pittsburgh. You know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But I was very respectful and humble, and looking at, you know, standing there with him in person and realizing, my God, this guy's a gorilla. I mean, shaking his hand. Bruno had giant bones. I mean, he was a big boned guy. Because he was about the same height I was, maybe 5'11 at the most. But he could carry, you know, 270, 280 pounds with a, you know, not a big waist at all because his bone structure was, you know, big. Bigger bones than I had. And he was very impressive. And to make a long story short, we had a nice little talk. And I'm not sure how we left it or whatever, but then there was a couple more times when I would drive by, see him, and then stop and go talk to him, you know, once in a while. And then we start talking about it, but then he found out I was wrestling, and he was impressed with my amateur record and me wrestling. And this was at a time when Bruno's career was starting to slow down. He was still in his prime, but instead of wrestling every day, he was just kind of wrestling the weekends, the big shows. Because he was already to the point where his elbows were, you know, beat and hurt, and his knees and back. And they didn't have the arthroscopic kind of surgeries and things back in those days they had these days. So, you know, he just would wrestle on the weekends on the big shows. And so he was home during the week at this kind of, you know, in date and time. So we just worked out. He had a gym in his basement, which consisted of a bench with a bunch of big plates, one incline bench, and some, you know, big-ass dumbbells. And that was it. But he invited me to, you know, come work out with him. And I couldn't believe it, so I did. So we wound up working out. He would work out every other day. We'd work out for about 3 hours, and an hour and a half or so was just on chest. And Bruno had, you know, a huge chest. I mean, and I could see how he got it. And the secret was heavyweights and wide grip. But so I started doing basically Bruno's workout. And I was probably 17, 18. And then when I started wrestling at 21, pretty, you know, before I kind of graduated, got the hell out of college. But I was weighing maybe 245, and I benched 465.5 pounds with the 1 second pause because I was doing his workout. We would do, you know, bench presses heavy all the way to our limit, you know, every other day. And after that, then we'd do the incline with some reps, but not a lot of reps, a lot of weight. And then after that, we'd do flies, you know, again, not a lot of reps, but a lot of weight. And then the upright rows, you know, like that build your trap muscles up. Remember how Bruno had no neck? Because it was, you know, and you can see some of the weightlifters now, they got, you know, big traps. So we'd do that. And then we'd do heavy biceps. We didn't do triceps because the triceps came in with the heavy benches. But then we do heavy biceps. And it would be almost a three-hour workout of, you know, the heaviest we could go weight. But that's what put the size on. And I couldn't hold the weight he could. Because my skeleton wasn't as big. He was huge boned. But for me, I kind of went when I met him from 160, 70 pounds. And then a few years later, I was like 245. I think 250 was the heaviest I ever was, but it was hard for me to hold that weight. I had to eat. I ate, you know, hoagie sandwiches before bed so I wouldn't lose weight sleeping. You know, that kind of stuff. You got, like, weightophobia. So that's kind of how it started. I just kind of walked into his life, and he was nice enough to take me under his wing. And that led to some other things that I had no idea about, because I was just, you know, a young guy, 20, 21, and I had no idea about politics, you know, or politics in the business. So I didn't realize that, you know, Bruno helping me and Bruno, you know, starting me, and as I started as Bruno's protege, I really didn't realize how the politics of that worked, because in those days, they didn't want you in the business. It was a very closed shop. They wanted people sitting in the seats holding the ticket stuff. Otherwise, you know, in those days, it was different. If you didn't sell tickets, you didn't eat. It wasn't like today with TV money and merchandise and all the, you know, stuff they got going today. So it was it was a different business. Shit, I forgot what the hell I was saying.
No, it's good, Larry, because there's a couple things I want to come off this topic with, and I want to get back to the politics of it here in a second.
Oh, the politics. That's what I was going to. Let me just finish.
Yeah, finish the politics.
Because there's so much to say, I'm trying to, you know, not cram it all in, but what I found out when I started, because I was Bruno's protege, I didn't even realize it, but they didn't want you in the business. But all the top guys of the day, like Chief J. Strongbow and Skolin and Savoldi's and Gorilla Monsoon and Killer Kowalski and all the top stars were really nice to me, and they would go out of their way to tell me things and teach me things, where if I was somebody else, they wouldn't even talk to you or let you in the building. You know, so I didn't realize at the beginning what an education I was getting that no one else was getting, because, you know, Bruno was the big star, so being nice to his protege was kind of a way of buttering him up.
Larry, this is an interesting thing, because here you are as a kid, young kid, watching Bruno on television. He's your hero. You find out where he lives through your mother. You crawl through the hedges. And then at one point, you're working out in Bruno's basement in Pennsylvania. Now, what's interesting about this is Bruno Sammartino is, without question, one of the legendary hand few of legendary guys that's ever been in the wrestling business. When you're in his business, or his basement, during a time when he was doing tremendous business, what kind of man was Bruno Sammartino? Had to be a good guy to let somebody he didn't know come work out in his basement.
Well, you know what? He was basically the guy he was on television when he would, you know, do an interview. He was a very humble guy. He was a very truthful guy. I mean, he came from a time, like I said, you know, out of World War II, and it was a different breed of men. But these guys, I mean, their word was their contract. You know, I mean, they were straight shooters, and, you know, Bruno was a very truthful, honest guy. If he said something, he meant it. You know, no bullshit. And very honorable, you know. I mean, and it was a breed of guy that, boy, I don't know if they exist anymore, coming from the time they came from. You know, I mean, he came from World War II and the suffering, and now we got a lot of people who are kind of don't have a clue how horrible this world can be sometimes. They just stare at their phones all day and think the world's going to give them stuff for free, and it ain't going to happen.
You know, Larry, Bruno is thought of in a lot of ways. Two ways that I've particularly heard, never having met the man. People who liked him said what you just said. He was a likable guy. He was a man of his word. He was a stand-up man. He was a different breed.
No shit.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the guys who don't like him say that he was difficult. He wanted to stay on top. He was driven by the money. He wanted to make sure he had his cut. He brought promoters to tears and made life difficult on them. Is the truth somewhere in the middle there with Bruno Sammartino, the man?
No, not at all. Not at all. The reality was, if anybody was jealous of Bruno, it was because they couldn't be like Bruno. And I remember times, Scott, when we'd pull up to an arena and me and Dominic DiNucci would have to almost carry Bruno into the arena. And because his back was hurting so bad, he couldn't walk. And the doc would be, you know, rubbing him down and getting him ready, because instead of, you know, saying, gee, I can hardly walk, I can't wrestle. Because today, I mean, they're very touchy about that. If you get a slight concussion or an injury, you know, they take you off, you know, until you can pass, you know, the physical. But in those days, you know, you couldn't do that. And Bruno would suffer, even though he couldn't walk, and go out and have a match, because he knew this. Because he was the top guy and drew the house, other, you know, people might be jealous, but Bruno was only there because he drew the house. And, you know, Vince McMahon Sr. kept him there because he drew the house. If it was someone else, they wouldn't be making the money. But Bruno knew, and he told me that being the top guy, it was his responsibility to make sure everybody under him on the undercard made as much money as they could. And the only way they could make more money is if Bruno showed up and no one asked for their money back and all that. So Bruno was, you know, taught me that, you know, even if you're hurt and can hardly walk, it's still your responsibility to go out there and make sure, you know, that you keep the money there, because all the guys under you, semi-main event and the opening bout guys and other guys, that they would all get a good payday, because the more people, the more money the bottom guys made. So he wasn't like that at all in terms. And the only term, I mean, him and, you know, Vince McMahon Sr. would bob heads a bunch. But that happened with all promoters and top guys because of the way the business was structured. There was no contracts, and some of the houses, I mean, you'd go out and you'd see, you know, 10,000 people sold out some building, but you have no really idea how much money, you know, was drawn, how much, you know, ticket money there was. So, you know, the promoter could say, oh, gee, well, we only drew, you know, $20,000, so here's everybody's payday, when in reality, maybe they drew $30,000, and everybody should have got paid more. So sometimes you had to, you know, stand up to make sure you got a fair payday. So that was a different art, too. I mean, there are guys that would look out at the arenas and, you know, count people and try to figure out how much, you know, money they brought in. So they make sure they got, a fair payday. And I mean, and it was guys, you know, too, like Captain Lou Albano and Ivan Putski and the Chief and the guys who weren't Bruno but were right under Bruno. You know, Bruno didn't do the smaller shows, but, you know, Strongbow and Putski and the other guys, you know, the Valiants and me and Gurria and Chief Maiva, there's Fuji and Tanaka, you know, it was a cast of characters. But he wasn't like that at all. He made sure that he did what he had to do to make sure everybody got the most money they could.
And I'm sure at some point we're going to do a full episode on the man Bruno Sammartino, because Larry went into the Hall of Fame the same night that Bruno went into the Hall of Fame, and also we'll talk about...
Well, not the same night.
Not, but the same Hall of Fame, I guess, is what I should say.
Yeah.
Yeah, the same Hall of Fame, and you were there
that
night.
That's an interesting story, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you were there the night he went in.
That was the first time, yeah, the first time. When Bruno went in the Hall of Fame, that was the first WrestleMania I was ever at.
And we will get to that, because we only have 14 minutes left here. It goes by fast, and we're going to do a whole show on Bruno, and also, sadly, Bruno's passing, because that has happened as well. But on this episode, one thing we want to talk about, because we're talking about Larry getting in the business. Okay, Larry, you now are a pro wrestler. You've trained with Bruno. In those days, it's a closed business. They want people in the seats. They don't want people in the ring. How do you get in the ring? How do you get booked? How did it happen?
Well, the way I got booked was, you know, Bruno called Vince McMahon Sr. and said, hey, I got a guy here I've been, working out with and getting ready for the business, and I'd like you to bring him in. And because Bruno was Bruno, Vince McMahon Sr. said, okay, great. And so that's how I got in. It was through the politics of knowing somebody. But, I mean, you know, there's no way I would have showed up at some building and knocked on the door and said, hey, can I talk to Vince McMahon Sr.? I want to be a wrestler. You know, they wouldn't even look at you. So, I mean, there was no wrestling school. It was, like I said, a closed shop. And the way guys got in, I mean, were kind of special ways. You either knew somebody good or you did something like Ken Patera, who was the Olympic, you know, weightlifting champion. So he, you know, did something impressive and was a world champion at something. And, you know, there were some other guys. And, you know, the Briscoes were national wrestling champions. And so, but there are some guys like Ernie Ladd or some other guys were, you know, football players that were in one sport. And then because they were so big, came into wrestling. But it was very hard to get in. In fact, nowadays, I'm looking at these guys, I'm going, my God, half of these guys ain't 200 pounds. You know, so they got their show 205 for the cruiserweight, so they got the cruiserweight division now, which is great, because they can fly all over the place, but they just don't draw money. You know, they're great to watch and kill TV time, but they're not big money draws.
Larry,
back in those days, if you were 180 pounds, 190 pounds, and tried to get in the wrestling business, you'd be laughed out the back door.
Larry, we have about 10 minutes left here, and I don't know that I've ever... I know, the clock's getting us. I don't know that I've ever heard you talk about this, so let's get all the details of this and what you remember. When, where, who was the opponent for Larry Zbyszko's first match?
Oh, my God. I'm trying to remember his name. You know, I started... Vince McMahon Sr., and he had a couple partners, you know, with the WWF, ran the Northeast Territory. But for a few years, for a while, Bruno ran Pittsburgh. That was like his town. And he ran little towns around Pittsburgh, like high schools. So sometimes on the weekends, you know, they'd run a high school building somewhere and have a wrestling show. And that's where I got my first start. The first match I had, God, I'm trying to remember this guy's name. He was from Canada. And I can't remember his name off the bat. But he was basically one of the guys you'd see on TV every week that would lose, you know. So, but I remember this. I was supposed to be on the first match. And I was strong as hell. I mean, I just benched 465. I was strong. I could break your neck. I was quick. I was good. And they said, okay, let's get ready for the first match. I got so nervous. I couldn't move. I went, no, I can't do it. I can't go out first. Wait, let me get into this. So they switched it, and they put another match on first, and I went on second. And walking out of the ring was the weirdest feeling for the first time that I didn't even think about until I did it. But I'm walking out and trying to walk out like a man, being, you know, 21. And I realized for the first time, everybody sitting in the stands, and it was winter, were dressed up, you know, with jackets and pants and clothes. And I felt, here I am walking out in a pair of boots and this little pair of tights. And for the first time it hit me, I go, my God, I feel naked. Standing in front of all these people with no clothes on. That was the first thing that hit me that I didn't even think about. And then trying to walk up the three steps to the ring, God, my knees were weak. It was hard walking up them three, those three things. And I was so nervous. When they rang the bell, I beat the guy pretty quick, and I probably hurt the poor bastard because I was so nervous. But that was the first one. That feeling of being like, yeah, I'm standing out here with no clothes on in front of all these people. That's weird. It's a weird feeling.
Larry, it's interesting. Without going too inside on this one, I don't know that this is a question I've ever heard asked anymore, but I don't, or asked anywhere. I don't think this is too inside. But where did Larry Zbysko come from?
Oh, Bruno named me that. There was a famous wrestler from the early 1900s, you know, Stanislaus Zbysko. And because I was Polish, my family name was Gwazdowski, and my dad changed it, you know, when he worked for U.S. Steel, so it wouldn't get all messed up in the corporate world. But Bruno was the one that gave me that name, because in those days, it was still a recognized, famous wrestling name. And I used to get a lot of people asking me, hey, was Stanislaus your grandfather? You know, because they still remember, you know, that. So that's where the Zbysko came from, was Bruno. He gave me the name.
Is it strange that now, close to 50 years later, when you walk through an airport, when you go to an event, when you appear anywhere, it's Larry Zbysko?
Yeah, I know. Try to spell that one. You know, the funny part is the WWE made a action figure. I think it's a Hall of Fame box with me and Scott Hall and Kevin Nash and Eddie Guerrero action figures, like a 4-pack. And on the box, they spelled my name wrong. So it could be a real collector's item down the road because the name's spelled completely wrong. Looks more like an eye chart.
At this point in your life, Larry, does anybody call you anything other than Larry Zbysko?
Well, not really. I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, my friends and family just call me Larry or Dad, but no one, if I meet somebody, it's just Larry Zbysko. You know.
Did your parents live long enough to see your first match?
Oh, yeah. Well, my mom wouldn't go. She was too horrified to go watch me get in the ring. And my dad, he's still living. He's 90. He's still doing good. But mom was afraid to go. She didn't want to go. She didn't like me doing that. She thought her baby would get hurt. You know? And it was funny. And my dad wasn't a big wrestling fan. You know, he'd say, hey, what do you want to do for your birthday? I'll take you and your buddies somewhere. Oh, we're going to the Pittsburgh Civic Arena to watch the wrestling matches. David, oh, God.
And he's still with us at 90 years old.
Yeah, Dad's 90. He'll be 91 in May. And he's doing good. You know, he's got a couple of artificial parts and a couple of cancer tumors removed over the years. But right now, he's healthy and mentally sharp and drives around. He's got a young girlfriend. She's only 79. So they hobble around together, and he's doing good.
I love it. Larry, with about 5 minutes left here, I do want to remind the fans out there again that this is a rare treat. If you want to talk to Larry Zbysko about what happened on the most recent edition of Monday Night Raw, All you do, send an email, osukid2006@aol.com. $50, we'll send you to PayPal, and you will get a call from wrestling's living legend, Larry Zbyszko. If you'd like a personalized, autographed photo, the only way to get them now, 8x10 color glossy, osukid2006@aol.com. $25, Larry will autograph it to you, and we will send it to your home. $50 for the call, $25 for the photo, osukid2006@aol.com. Larry, with a few minutes, and don't forget, next week's podcast will be all about the journey that Larry Zbyszko has had with Eric Bischoff, which started back in the AWA and led to one of the biggest buy rates, well, the biggest buy rate in the history of World Championship Wrestling, Ted Turner's Wrestling Company. In December of 1997, Bret Hart was the referee. All kinds of insights there. But Larry, in the 4 minutes we have left in episode number one, when you look back at the early days of your career, what was the business like in your mind? When you look in your mind's eye, there's no tape of that. What do you see when you think of that?
Well, it's hard to describe. It was just a completely different lifestyle. It was, you were definitely not living a normal life. We basically, you know, lived in our cars. We drove all day to one town, then we wrestled at night, and then we can get some sleep in or drive all night or whatever. But, you know, and because we wrestled every night, we didn't, you know, get a chance to watch TV. So it was years. I have no idea what, you know, was going on television or what the big shows were. But it was a life that, because wrestling didn't want you in the business, and the boys, you know, like were like a true brotherhood and kept the rest of the world out. Because once the fans got to know you, you weren't special to them anymore. So you wanted to stay away, and you wanted to, you know, the people had more fun if they didn't know your real self.
Larry,
actually, I got sick of driving around so much. I became a private pilot and just flew myself to a lot of towns with some guys. Got a couple classic stories about that, too.
Larry, one thing I wanted to ask you, and we talked about some things that we were not going to talk about on this podcast as other podcasts do, and one of those things was money. So I'm just going to ask this in a broad sense. When you're breaking into the business in the year that you did, obviously prior to 1980, prior to cable television, just was the money livable? Could you support yourself in an average lifestyle?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we were wrestling every night, you know, and then a lot of times, you know, like me and Gurria and Strongbow or someone, but you had your big car, and everybody would pitch in for expenses. And two guys would split a hotel room, or sometimes one guy would get a hotel room and two other guys would, you know, take the mattress off the other bed and sleep on the floor. So, and everybody would chip in. And so we did weird things to, you know, save on expenses. But back in those days in the, you know, early 70s, if you were making $400 or $500 a week, that was, you know, that wasn't all that bad.
In today's money, that's not all that bad at all. I don't have the...
back in the 70s, I mean, I bought a new Cadillac for $5,500.
So, the rest of the... Yeah.
But, yeah. And the thing that, even this podcast we're trying, we'll see what happens, but the only thing, I mean, besides my family and my kids, I mean, the other thing special to me was the fans. The fans don't, I'd like them to realize really how special they are to all the wrestlers out there. Because when you walk into a room full of fans and they blow the roof off the place or chant Larry at Nitro, and I mean, that was an addictive buzz. I mean, an energy, a positive energy. And even this, I don't do much. I'm becoming more of a hermit the older I get, and the crazier the world is getting. But I enjoy once in a while going out, and the only reason I do that is because I like meeting the fans. And I'm surprised how many young people, you know who the hell I am.
And
I will look forward. I'm looking forward to going. I'll be at WrestleCon during WrestleMania, you know, in Tampa. So, and I'll be with a bunch of guys. That'll be fun. Yeah, I just did a movie. We'll talk about that next show. I just did a movie for a month, and Stan Hansen was in it for a couple days and some other guys. But there's this guy, a nice guy, big wrestling fan. His name's Greg Weiss. He's bringing, like, a bunch of guys in to this WrestleCon. And so I'm going to be one of them. And there's a couple guys there that I had some classic feuds with that people talked about for years. Like Barry Windham with the Western States belt and Paul Orndorff with the National Heavyweight belt and Killer Brooks and Baron Von Raschke, Dory Funk Jr., Austin Idol. There's going to be a bunch of guys I haven't seen for a while that I'm going to enjoy seeing, and then the fans should have a good time. If it wasn't for the fans, I wouldn't be here, brother, so God bless them.
And God bless you, Larry. We will be back next week with Episode 2, The Eric Bischoff Evolution with Larry Zbyszko. Larry, you have a tremendous week, and we will talk again 1 week from now.
Okay.